What's up, Mets fans? Big episode today. A little bit of a mailbag for you. We're answering your questions from Twitter. Make sure you're following us so you can be involved in one of the upcoming ones, because I'm sure there are. The only other thing we have to talk about is some random Mets moves. There's not that much, but we're going to answer your guys' questions. We're answering all of them. Let's get to it. What is up, Mets fans? Welcome back to another episode of the Mets Up Podcast. As you heard from the intro, we are going through a mailbag today because, let's be honest, James, there just hasn't been a lot going on in Mets world besides a couple 40-man cuts, a couple random relievers being picked up here and there, and I'm sure we'll get to them throughout the episode, but it's a mailbag episode, and we haven't been able to really do one of these properly in quite some time.
No, we got a lot of good questions from you guys. Excited to answer them. Excited to shout you guys out, everyone who engaged with us on Twitter. And shout out everyone who's been engaging with us on Twitter anyway. Our Twitter's been bumping since the big change, since the transition. And it's been great, honestly, because it's something that I love to do. It's fun also just to make funny posts, engage with you guys, like making memes about everything. It's a great time. So shout out everybody engaging. Shout out everything that's been going on the last few weeks. And let's get some questions.
Yeah, let's get to it. And we'll start off just right at the top from our boy, Jenny Metz, who asks, biggest sleeper pitching prospect? More of a question for the pitching guru at James Schiano. A little bit offended that he doesn't want to know my opinion as much. But James, the floor is yours. I'm going to let you take that one first.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of this podcast, like, you think you're a little better at hitting, but I think I offer a little bit more from the pitching side. But Mets have a lot of great sleeper prospects in the system. One of my favorites, he hasn't pitched yet for the Mets, Wyatt Huedepohl, draft pick last year, came from University of Charlotte, the 49ers, I believe. I think he was like 6th, 7th, 8th round pick around there. He had some crazy games in college, just really showed off how much better of a pitcher he was and how much more advanced he was than a lot of hitters. Had a complete game with 17 strikeouts and no walks against Old Dominion, which isn't even that bad of a college baseball program.
No, but Old Dominion, that's where Justin Verlander and his brother Ben also came from. And I believe, there's one more player in the pros right now. Is it Nick Prado that went to Old Dominion? There's like a Kansas City Royal that went there, one of them. Good school.
Don't know. But he has a power curveball. It's very sharp and had a 50% whiff rate his last year in college. And he has a low 90s fastball, but it has really good shape on it. Great hop, great carry. But he's a big guy, and he has like a nice starting pitching body. So it feels like this is the kind of prospect where he comes into the Mets pitching lab. His fastball already has good shape. He has very good command. He gets 3 more ticks on that fastball, and it's off to the races of being like a high-profile pitching prospect.
Yeah, and I mean, when we spoke to Matt Eddy on last episode, if you guys didn't check it out, full prospect breakdown over there. But he brought up the name Nolan McLean a lot. And that's someone that they took last year as a two-way player in the draft out of Oklahoma State, a guy who had been used in the reliever role that he said the Mets are looking to stretch out to a starter, something that they're kind of actively doing with a lot of these players that they took in the draft, hoping that they're going to be able to get some length. So he's also a name to keep an eye out for, Nolan McLean.
Yeah, and of that same ilk, there's another guy like real deep one, Brett Banks, another draft pick from last year. Ooh. He had top 10 stuff plus in all of Division I college baseball last year. Shout out my guy Mason McRae, one of my favorite sources for college baseball information, data, statistics. And he's another guy. He had 3 appearances for the Mets last year in the Complex League. He was a reliever in all of them, but there have been talks that he's going to become a starter. Another just high-powered fastball, great rising action. I think he has a distinct slider and curveball, if I remember correctly, but I could be mixing him up with another prospect. But Brett Banks, a guy, Wyatt Huedepohl, another guy, Austin Troser from last year's draft class from Missouri. He, in his time in Missouri, went from throwing 90 to throwing 99 miles an hour from freshman year when he was drafted. In 1 year, just freshman year, he went from 90 to 98.
Wow. I mean, yes. Missouri is like the original pitching lab in college baseball. That's where Max Scherzer came from. A lot of great pitching guys out of there.
Yeah, he had 1 inning in the Complex League as well, struck out the side, got up to 97 miles an hour, and he throws heat, has a good slider and a changeup. I love an SEC pitcher. I love Missouri. He's a big kid. He also put on 20-something pounds his first semester in Missouri as well. So this is someone who's probably coming in raw, still growing into his body a little bit, kind of still probably learning how to pitch rather than just throw. This Mets pitching draft class from last year, I think, is going to bear a lot of fruit in terms of sleeper pitching prospects.
Awesome. Yeah. Jenny Metz, glad you got your account back. Thank you for that awesome question. Are we going to read out our friend Tyler's question here? Do we want to just talk about that real quick? Because it does some Mets in it. Why do the Mets continue to scoop up the Yankee scraps and think it will work for them? And you replied perfectly with a picture of Marcus Stroman, who, of course, just got a nice little contract from the Yankees to pitch there for the next 2 years. Listen, they got Harrison Bader. They got Luis Severino. Am I missing anybody else that they've picked up that's a scrap from them?
No. I mean, it could be a bullpen guy, but not that I would remember right now off the bat.
I mean, listen, Severino could be very good this year. Someone that we've both been pretty high on, you particularly. And, I mean, Harrison Bader's going to play good defense for us and just give us a little bit more of a better Tim LeCastro, like we said. So, are these the Yankee scraps? I guess. But, like, let's not pretend like the Yankees aren't picking up Mets guys, too.
No, this is just part of the newfound norm now where Yankees fans have become obsessed with Mets fans because they're just not alone at the top anymore. And, again, neither team's at the top. Both teams missed the playoffs last year. Both had pretty disappointing seasons. But now there's just another big dog in the fight, and the Yankees fans are going to keep taking shots. I think the Yankees giving up on Severino was a mistake. I think he's going to be awesome this year. Everything points to like there being, with health, a real bounce back at hand. He posted some great videos to Driveline last week, working on his changeup, which I had talked about when the Mets signed him a few months ago, whereas like this could be the pitch that like just fucking changes everything for him. Where
it was nasty in that
disgusting.
Video.
And it was disgusting. Also that great arm side run on it to really go away from lefties, because Severino has struggled with lefties because he throws the fastball at them and he throws a slider that comes in on them. Just to have another weapon against them would be super important to him. But I think those are the only two Yankee guys. And Bader, like who the fuck cares about Harrison Bader? He's a defensive center fielder. He's getting a 1-year contract. They're both on 1-year contracts. It's just
Yankees fans pretending like they didn't parade him around when he hit like 3 home runs in the playoffs. They're like, this guy's going to be the next big thing, another steal. And then they cut him like 6 months later. So
Tyler also, I just know from being on the inside, just being one of my good friends, like he's gutted about Michigan. Me and him both went to Ohio State together. And it's been a whole week of just like getting spam updates for him about the transfer portal. So it's good for me to keep up with it. But also like, I know that he's just, as a sports fan right now, like he was really over excited when the Cowboys and the Eagles both lost this weekend as a Giants fan. So just from that, I could feel that he is a little bit on edge right now as a sports fan. So just him just chomping at the bit to reply to our podcast feed is kind of more part of that.
Yeah, no, definitely. All right, we got another one here from Dave at Really Cold Take. Trajectory for 2023 draft picks. Where do they start? Where do they end? Mainly on Hauk, Boston Barrow, AJ Ewing, and Brandon Sproat. So, I mean, all these guys, the best thing I feel like that could happen for any of them would be double A by the end of the year. But that's like everything went extremely perfectly right. Colin Hauk, Boston Barrow, AJ Ewing, and Sproat all really didn't have much time last year. At the professional level, I think a couple of guys had a little bit more than the others. Hauk, of course, being the first round pick. Sproat's probably the one that has a chance to rise the most just because of age and being a pitcher, if I had to guess.
We heard a lot about Sproat from Matthew Eddy again last week on the Big Prospect Show.
Formal Matthew Eddy. Check it out.
Yeah. And it was the fact that something similar has happened with Christian Scott recently. And now we've seen like Christian Scott rise all the way up to number 88 on Baseball Prospectus' top prospects list. And I know Baseball Prospectus in their list, more than other lists, takes in pitch shape and pitch design significantly more than results. And that's why I like their rankings for pitching significantly more than any other site. And similarly, like Matt Eddy mentioned with Scott, the Mets are taking Sproat from Florida, who really pushes like sinkers, sliders, changeups. And they're, I think, probably because he throws 100 miles an hour already almost, are going to give him a fastball. And right now, Christian Scott has one of the best fastball shapes of any pitcher in the entire minor leagues. He's going to come up to the major leagues with an elite fastball. So I think it's a good chance Sproat does that because, if correct me if I'm wrong, I think that he did not pitch last year for the Mets, just went straight to the lab.
I believe so.
And I think that was also true of Hugh LaPole and Brett Banks. We got that one inning. And another guy 2 years ago, Jonah Tong, who I think is also exciting. But Sproat's a guy where I think there's a chance if like his numbers are good enough in the lab, or he could do like 2 weeks or even none at St. Lucie and go right to Brooklyn. And once you're in Brooklyn, it's just there's a good chance you end the year at Double A. So again, the young hitters, it's probably going to just take a while. They probably are complex. They're probably low A. It's going to be a very long time till they make an impact in the major leagues. But Sproat's the guy who, if it clicks, if it hits right, like that could be someone who moves quickly.
Yeah, all those hitters were in the complex league last year, so probably going to start off there a little bit, maybe in like low A with Port St. Lucie. Double A is probably the best possible outcome, realistically, for any of those guys. They're also all so young. I think they're all 18 or 19 years old. Like, we saw Jet Williams get to Double A by the end of the year last year, which was phenomenal. That's unlikely for most minor league players just in general.
Yeah, Jet's just elite. Like, Jet does things that other players at his age can't really do. Like, his command of the plate, his back control, and how hard he can hit the ball at his size, like, that's special. Like, and also that you could kind of reflect that in where they were drafted. Like, Colin Hauk had this idea of he was, like, a top 10 talent, but he's more of someone who they just see as probably, like, a major leaguer rather than someone who's going to be an elite major leaguer. Like, Jet had the elite tools. He just had to overcome size, which is something that's a risk willing to take, where Hauk is like probably going to wind up a second, third baseman, just do a lot of things well, but never be spectacular anywhere, which is the exact same profile that got Brooks Lee drafted, where like what, ninth overall, sixth overall.
He was fourth, I think, overall, or fifth or sixth or whatever. Yeah.
Now he's like on the doorstep of the major leagues and it's still just not really good at anything, but he's really good. He's like a good player all around, which I think is the expectation for Hauk. But I think that Barrow and Ewing had a little bit bigger tools, but probably a little more projection on them. So generally, it's just going to take a while for everyone.
Yeah, going to take a long time. Speaking of taking a long time, the international prospects all signed actually on my birthday, January 15th. So we got to see some big names there. And this next question from Connor Ray comes in and he says, thoughts on the Vladdy signing? And of course, when he's saying Vladdy, he's talking about Vlad Guerrero Sr.'s son, Vladdy Miguel Guerrero, I believe is his name. 16 or 17-year-old that the Mets signed as an international prospect. He plays the outfield with a left-handed swing, right-handed thrower. He says, is there a chance he's as good as his father or brother, or is it just the last name giving him more hype than deserved? Listen, there's always a chance, but we're talking about 16, 17-year-old. These are boys. They're not even men. They're still boys. They're still growing. There's still things that are changing. I mean, think about what we were doing as 16 or 17-year-olds and where we're looking at. Did you even have a beard at 16 or 17 yet?
That was like the first time I actually did have one, because you remember Hurricane Irene, the first hurricane. Oh, no, it was Sandy. It was Hurricane Sandy. My house lost power for almost a month. So we didn't have hot water for like a week or two. No.
What the hell? How'd you lose it for a month?
3 weeks. We lost a lot of power. We weren't in school for almost a month.
Really? Am I forgetting this?
Yeah, I don't know. What were you doing then?
Playing a lot of video games, I think. Just a lot of FIFA, probably.
That was, pullback curtain. Those were really Mark's gremlin days when he was like 14, 15, 16, 17. He wasn't much of a socialite, but...
It was baseball and video games. That's what it was.
Which is exactly the way your life is now. But nevertheless, I didn't shave for like a month thing, because I was like, my house is cold water, it's dark, I don't want to shave. I just grew a beard. I was like, oh, this is kind of cool, I'll grow a beard. So this is the first time I grew a beard. But have to stress that with the international signing period, this is... It's nothing worth really talking about, thinking about as fans. Like, maybe he is good. Maybe someone, Mets got another gem in this class. I know they signed one of the highest catchers in the pool. Basically, unless you're in a year where there's like a blatant Jason Dominguez, it's not something as fans that we have to be like all over. Even the same year as Jason Dominguez, Robert Poisson, who I'm sure 95% of his podcast listeners have never heard of, got the same bonus as him from the Oakland A's. And he's never going to get close to the major leagues. So
the only reason he might is just because the A's are like, we got it. We paid him more money than we give to almost any player on our major league roster. Let's just see if he's good. And if he stinks, he'll probably disappear into the ether of Major League Baseball. But even go back a couple years ago, remember Simone Juan was the big name of like, ooh, the Mets got Simone Juan, this international prospect who's 16 years old. There's still plenty of time. He's only 18 now, but he has an OPS of 619 in 93 games. And that was like the one that everyone was hyping up. So we urge you with the utmost caution to not freak out about the international prospects. When you need to find out who these guys are, you will be told. They will tell you. You will find out. It won't be a secret anymore. Until then, it's just kind of an exercise of just patience at this point.
It's also just a way for people on Twitter to get cheap impressions by saying things and names. It's really nothing. It's just a way for people to regurgitate things that are very obvious and just say them back to you. And the one thing that I think was really significant about the Mets international signing period, just the day celebration in general, was the fact that, first of all, the entire conglomerate was there, Stearns, Mendoza, a lot of the people, and then also Francisco Alvarez, who came back to hand out diplomas to members of the Mets Dominican Academy who had graduated high school degree, American, I think GED, just giving out these diplomas, something that Alvarez got a few years ago. And there was a word going around from Andy Martino that the Mets have graduated the most people, giving them the most diplomas of any Dominican Academy recently. Whoa. And we know the money that's gone into this Dominican Academy over the last few years and how relevant that is for building a pipeline of major league talent. And someone like Alvarez, who is the best case scenario, basically, of what can happen. Not the best case scenario because he is not Ronald Acuna, he's not Julio Rodriguez, but basically the best case scenario of signing a child and turning them into a professional baseball player who is also a man who stands by his team and is building himself into being a good leader. And that's like something for these, children to see when they're here in the Mets Academy. And they can look to Alvarez and be like, this is our guy. Like, this is a serious thing. I know that Juan Soto was also famous for doing this back in the day, going back to Nationals Academy when he was still like 21, similar to Alvarez right now. And Christopher Morel also just did this for the Cubs this past week as well. So I think that's the most significant part about this, is that Francisco Alvarez is displaying true leadership qualities and giving all of these, for the last time, children someone to look up to as they move through the Mets Academy.
Yeah, 1,000%. That's probably the most we'll talk about these international prospects for you guys. So sorry if you wanted to hear more. We're just not going to be one of those podcasts that like lies to you and tells you like, this guy's going to be great. And then you don't hear about him ever because he's 16 years old. Keep that in mind. And if you're not 16 years old when you're getting signed, chances are you're probably not that good. So we'll move on to the next question here. This one comes from Wolfie. Shout out Wolfie, a friend of the podcast and channel. What's your thoughts on one of the best Mets of all time, R.A. Dickey? It's a little bit random, but I mean, a lot of great memories with R.A. Weirdly, is one of the best Mets pitchers ever, especially because he won a Cy Young. I only have positive memories and thoughts with him, and that was probably one of the cooler Linsanity runs we've ever seen in baseball, for sure.
It was even more than Linsanity because he went for multiple seasons of being like one of the better pitchers. It was just, I remember those true, like, yeah. That week in June where he was like pushing no hitters back to back years. Yeah. I think in 2009, where I was like, this is 2010. This is fucking crazy. But we also have to always hold R.A. Dickey in high regard because he helped spurn like the Mets World Series run by acquiring Noah Syndergaard and Travis d'Arnaud. So it was like, he always will have a piece of a great Mets season, even though he wasn't a part of it, because he helped acquire two of the players that were part of it. So that goes to show Mets fans also, like, give these prospects a few years. Maybe sometimes really good things will happen on the other end of it.
100%. All right, Richard Hernandez, he hit us with a trivia question the other day. He's got a question for us, though, on this one. Best possible road trip or flight destination for a Mets road game this season? That is a good one. I'm going to have to pull up the Mets schedule because I don't know what American League teams we go to. Obviously, you play every National League team on the road at some point during the season. But in terms of the American League, I mean,
I'll say off the bat, LA in April is a great trip. You get a little taste of summer before summer. I did that last year. They go up to San Francisco too, which is a taste of winter after winter in April, but having summer before summer, a nice weekend in April. Also, it just happens to be for the second year in a row, the Mets playing the Dodgers in LA on 420, which is a fun wrinkle. As far as American League, I'm looking at the schedule now. The Mets go to the World Series champion Rangers next year. The Mets go to Cleveland, which I know Mark will scoff at, but it's a good place to watch a game. I spent some time there in college. It's one of those cities where it's like, I'll never pick it as a destination, but it's like, it's a good ballpark to see. And like, it's just good. It's good, hearty Midwest people.
I also like Seattle. I think Seattle is a place that I've never been, but I've only ever heard good things about. So I definitely want to maybe try and get out to the West Coast for that one. And Colorado. I mean, well, Colorado is not American League, duh, but that would be a great one as well. And I think the most obvious choice always is the San Diego Padres. Anytime you got a chance to go to San Diego and watch some baseball, you should do that, because you're not only going to see some good players, you're going to have some incredible, impeccable weather as well.
Also, funny scheduling quirk. You guys are going to get ready for my rants about the schedule as we get closer to the season, of course, but just a big part of it. The Mets' entire season is basically a Milwaukee Brewers sandwich this year. Yeah. We open the season at home opener against the Brewers, and we end the season Friday, Saturday, Sunday in Milwaukee. So
the whole
season is just about the Brewers. So I think that could also be a cool road trip where I don't know next year's NFL schedule at all, but if the Packers are home on Sunday, September 29th, it's probably a good excuse to get out to Lambeau Field.
Is Green Bay close to Milwaukee? That's the next question.
I mean, it's in Wisconsin. It can't be that far.
I don't know. It was like 3 hours. Is that too far for you if it was that far?
No, I think 3 hours would be pushing the limit of it, though. I'm hoping it'd be like an hour and a half, and I think it is, but I don't know. I totally making it up.
I mean, you're the Midwest guy, so I thought maybe you had a beat on Wisconsin. Apparently not.
No, I went one time. It was an 8-hour drive from Columbus to Madison, which was way longer than I thought it was going to be. So the Midwest just stretches out.
Kenosha, right?
Kenosha, Wisconsin.
All right, Ethan Briggs with the next question for us. Can you talk about what you know about player development improvements, Pitching Lab, Eric Jaegers? We did a little bit last episode, but essentially from what at least we know, or I know, James can speak afterwards, Eric Jaegers is the man. He's got some special sauce cooking where he just seems to be able to identify pitchers that have the ability to get more out of what they've shown thus far. Like a guy you mentioned with Christian Scott, like a guy that you even mentioned with Mike Vassell, who was taken more as a safe pick, as a guy who is a good pitcher, didn't have really anything plus-plus, but now, after last season, was able to show that he has some strikeout ability, has some good pitches, has the opportunity to maybe make the major league roster at some point during the season. So it seems like he's able to identify the pitchers that have the ability to get more. And that's something that I think is so incredibly important, and what you've seen a lot of top organizations do.
Yeah, and something else I like about Jaegers is that it seems that we've gone from a results-based, development model to a strengths-based development model, where it's like we again, I don't think the Mets are drafting or having guys in the minor leagues to worry about ERA and WHIP and their wins. Like, I think they're like, let me see which pitch properties we can coax out of these players, and let's make sure these are where they have to be, rather than like making sure you have a 2.7 ERA. Like, Jaegers comes from Driveline. He worked closely with Kyle Boddy, who started the Driveline and ran the Reds player development for many years. It's just, this is going to be what it is. It's going to be trying to think of how to say this, even just putting a lot of technical ability into player development here. Lots of machines, lots of sensors and things to trend high speed cameras. It's a lot of things like that. And that's as much as we know about it, because every single team really wants to keep their player development under wraps because they don't want other teams to know what they're doing, because you don't want someone else to steal your methods and your little secret sauce, as Mark said so eloquently. So I just know that the way that we're improving pitchers right now, and the way that we have a lot of, for lack of a better term, balls to draft a pitcher and then say, we're going to change your role, we're going to change your arsenal. And the fact that those things are happening quickly, especially with guys like Christian Scott and Blake Tidwell, Christian Scott literally becoming one of the best pitching prospects in the entire minor leagues after being drafted just 2 years ago as a relief pitcher. I think that's the kind of thing where you could be like, okay, like we have plans in place and players are executing them. I think that itself is a really good thing for this development machine we are creating.
Totally. And on the hitting side, I mean, there's just been a lot of major leaguers that have been homegrown that have come through the Mets in the last 5-10 years. Like, you look around the diamond, at almost every single position, you have a guy that is relatively homegrown. So I think on the hitting side, they've continued to do what they've done well. They brought in that guy from the Royals, right, last year that you were telling me about, that, or was he from the Rangers? Where'd he come from?
I think the Royals guy's already gone for someone new, honestly. I think it was already a swap job was done.
Okay, he got upgraded. But hey, even so, like, there's just been a lot of guys on the offensive side too coming up through the minors. So I think there's definitely some good things going on there in terms of player development. Next question, Big V. If each of you can make a wild prediction for the upcoming season that you believe could happen, what would it be? And he says trade, player performance, overall season standings, maybe some sneaky move the Mets make. James, I'm going to let you go first.
Thanks so much. You're going to let me go first. How kind of you.
That's the benefit of reading the questions.
Yeah, a wild prediction the Mets make.
I mean, like, one that you had last year was like the Diamondbacks are going to be pretty good. That was pretty good.
Yeah, but I think I'm trying to think of one like specific Mets. Specific Mets, crazy prediction. I think Jorge Lopez is going to be a really good reliever. Ooh. I think Jorge Lopez is just going to be nice. I just think he's going to be someone that sneaks up on everybody. And you look up in June, you're like, oh, I really trust Jorge Lopez as like the seventh inning guy. That's my sneaky prediction.
My bold prediction is Brandon Nimmo's going to hit 30 home runs. I think we're going to see a 30 home run season out of Brandon Nimmo, moving him to the corner maybe a little bit more for Harrison Bader.
24 last year? How bold is that?
He has never done it. He set a career high last year.
In like 135 games. He's on the 30 homer pace. Mark's like, this is my bold prediction. It's going to happen.
If Brandon Nimmo hits 30 home runs, there's not one person in Major League Baseball who is like, I saw that coming. Find someone else who's saying it and then tell me it's not a wild prediction.
Yeah, that's fine. Whatever. Great job.
Yeah, Jorge Lopez was a great reliever 2 years ago, James. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah. All right. Next question from Theo A. Yeah, you are right about that. So yeah, fuck me, I guess. But Theo A, Shea said he's pod. Another one specifically for me, but I want Mark to answer it too. But I think he also answered the question in the question for us. The best pitch for any Mets pitcher. And he said, so like the DS slider or the Senga forkball. I think that's it. I think you nailed it. One and two right there. Senga's forkball last year, third best whiff rate of any pitch in baseball. I think second best soft contact rate. It gave up one home run the whole year, and it was like in the last month of the season. It's disgusting. There's no pitch like it in baseball. It's the significant reason why he's as good as he was.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with Edwin Diaz's slider being bad. It has everything to do with Senga's forkball being arguably the most unique pitch in all of baseball right now. Definitely the choice there. Next up, we got Yoshima. Professor Yoshima, big Mets fan. He's always around. Who will be the biggest breakout in 2024 for Fran? Do one offensive and one pitcher.
Offensive. I'm just going to say it till it's wrong.
Should we say it at the same time? Yeah, Brett Beatty.
Brett Beatty is going to be Brett Beatty. Brett Beatty is going to have a good year. If he doesn't have a good year, then you guys can all be like, we told you so. But the elite prospect who has good bat-to-ball skills, great exit velocities, and good makeup that was a first-round pick and dominated every level of the minors, I think he's still going to be good, even though he only has 400 plate appearances in the major leagues of being bad. So that's my pick, Brett Beatty.
Yeah, Brett Beatty definitely on the offensive side. There's also, truthfully, not many guys you can actually pick to break out because the Mets roster is full of a lot of veterans. So there's not really much of a offensive breakout. On the pitching side, I know who you're going to go with. So I'm going to go with someone else. I'm going to go with Jose Budo. I think Jose Budo just cements himself as like a starting pitcher in Major League Baseball. Breakout maybe is a little bit bold because what is a breakout for a guy who's probably going to have like a 4-5 ERA maybe on the year. But I think just him becoming a real major leaguer and probably being a part of this rotation for the next couple of years feels like something that's going to happen.
Damn, I was going to say Budo. So I'll pull back on that and just say my guy, Christian Scott.
Thought you were going.
Yeah, I'll do it. I think Christian Scott's going to come to the major league this year and really shock people about that he's as ready as he is. I still don't know if he's going to come up as a traditional starter just because the Brewers took a while for them to ease guys into starting when they came up. Peralta, Burns, Woodruff, even Aaron Ashby, Stills, he's easing his way into starting 3 years later. But Christian Scott's awesome. He's so good. I'm all over him right now. All right, then. Next question, JSF Nation. If you had to pick one pitcher and one position player slash DH for the Mets to sign, who would it be? Mark.
Okay, so position player is going to be Jorge Soler. I think...
Here's the philosophical question. Is he a position player? He doesn't play a position.
He said DH as well. DH was part of it. Yes, DH was part of it. That's why I snuck him in there. It's definitely Jorge Soler. He is probably one of the best bats available. I can't think of the other ones right now off the top of my head, but I'm going to go with Jorge Soler. He's just really good, and I think he would bring just that extra needed power that the Mets could use outside of Pete Alonso and Francisco Lindor right now. And then in terms of the pitching side, who am I going to want on the pitching side here that's not completely boring?
Yeah, ugh. I have two answers. One fake one, one real one. Fake one's just Blake Snell. Like, Blake Snell's just a really good pitcher. Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen to him. I don't know where he's going to sign. It's January 16th. There's not even half a rumor. We've even got on it with over the weekend, just pretending that the Mets had a chance to sign Blake Snell. Got a nice tweet with some nice engagement, but all those rumors seem totally fake. I don't know who's going to sign him. I don't know when. I don't know where. I don't even know why. I don't even know who's going to ask, but it's bizarre. And then another pitcher, Ryan Stanek. Ryan Stanek's awesome. Stuff's crazy. Throws 100 with a splitter and a slider. Yeah, that has to be the guy.
I know what pitcher I want. I want Brandon Woodruff. He's still available, and I'd love to sign him to a two-year deal where you completely pay him to be hurt for a year, and then the next season he's good. So I'm going to go Brandon Woodruff. That's the one I'm interested in right now. Bring back the Stearns connection there. There's not a lot of great pitching left, to be honest.
No, I mean, it's a lot of anything left besides Soler, Snell, and Bellinger. It's a bizarre free agency period. It's just weird.
Super, super weird.
Another one from Ethan Briggs doubling up on us. You guys can answer this many times you want to going forward. Whenever we mailbag, if you have seven questions, just type all seven in. We love it. We don't care. And we'll probably read them if they're good questions. How would you judge Billy Epler's tenure? How much was he actually in charge? Which is a hilarious way the question. That's good credit to us to think we would actually know, because we don't. And then what on earth happened with the sketchy firing quitting? Also, really nice of you to think that we'd know the answer to that question too. I don't know. I think Billy Epler's tenure is like one of, if you probably would judge it differently based on your expectations of the guy who architected the Anaheim Angels, where it's like there were a lot of good things that happened, also a lot of things that were like and then the end of it was like but then like all the prospects we got last year wound up looking like pretty good, so I'll give him a solid B-, and then I think it was also as good as I possibly could have expected the day he got hired, B-.
Definitely had way lower expectations for him coming in. I genuinely thought he was a stupid person. Like, what he did with the Angels was concerning, and you're like, oh, this we hired this guy? Like, this is not going to be good. He made those big moves, like you said. The prospect thing at the end, I think, was really savvy, and that probably saved him a little bit in what was a disastrous 2023 season. But overall, I mean, he probably is going to get a worse rep than he actually deserved for his time with the Mets. And I don't know, the firing at the end, there's a new president of baseball operations. Like, at the end of the day, whatever was going on with that stuff that was going on in the news with him about if he was, what was it, interfering or...
I think it was service time manipulation or something. I don't know.
Whatever it was.
Allegedly, we're not, not on the record.
Seemed like a great reason for him to just walk away from an organization that he's no longer in charge of. So I think that's really what ended up happening.
Yeah, sometimes in life you have to look at timing and like realize context and be like, okay, whatever. I'm not going to think about this anymore.
No, Billy Epler will be fine. He's going to get another job in baseball somewhere for sure. Okay. Yeah. Young MB _2_. That's an interesting username, I gotta say. Favorite Mets team that you grew up with, I'm assuming. Could also answer, which Mets team do you think was the best in the last 24 years? So, I mean...
I think those are the same answer. I think the best team and my favorite team was 2006. It's also funny to think about because, like, it's fucked up. Mets fans don't want to hear it. But, like, I think the 2017 was probably better than 2016.
Yeah.
Just because it had Johan Santana on it, and I think that is incredibly relevant. A team that probably could have gone all the way, just they're really good. I think I put them against every other team we've seen, Mets teams in our lives. The 2022 team, while it was great, I think by the end they showed they have a lot of cracks in their armor. The 2015 team objectively sucked.
It's bad.
Every day I wake up, I'm like, how'd the team go to the World Series? It's kind of ridiculous. Look back at their roster, like, these guys sucked. Like, why are they in the World Series? But we were talking about the other day, the Mets in that World Series went to there. Like, people always preach, like, this new Mets up the middle defense. Like, that's as strong as you want to be, as you want to be anywhere in the field. The Mets had a catcher that couldn't throw, a shortstop that couldn't move, a second baseman with no hands, and a center fielder who was not a center fielder, and Yoenis Cespedes. And all of those things together did cost them the World Series in totality, but also somehow got them there. So, I don't know. But I think by far the best Mets team in our lives were 06 and 07.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, technically 2000, I think, would be up there too, but 06, 07, I think, was a better run than that 2000 team necessarily.
The 2000 team also was like, it was a really good team, but it was also like not anywhere close to a lot of the other teams playing baseball in that era.
Correct.
But yeah. That was also the kind of thing where the Mets like chipped away and chipped away and chipped away in 98 and 99. And like that was just a veteran roster with experience and know-how. Bobby Valentine, good manager, just like to get over the hump and get to the World Series rather than like we're going to walk in here and take a World Series.
Yes, I think Mike Hampton had a career season that got him paid big time. Like there was a lot of things that went right for that team that year.
Bobby Jones.
Yeah. Bobby Jones. My first ever Mets game that I went to, Bobby Jones made the start. He got shelled by the Braves, absolutely destroyed, which makes a lot of sense. All right, Bella, I think one of our few female listeners and female fans of the podcast will take it. That's fine. You guys traveled around the ballpark a lot last year. Where are the best seats in Citi Field and why? Like, what food is near there? Are the seats just good themselves? We've spent a lot of time the last couple of seasons. I mean, the best seat's obviously always going to be like behind home plate. But I think when you're asking that question, it's always about like value and what's like a really just good place to be. I really think those 300s are like some of the better seats where you're above like all the chaos and all the noise. You get the access to the Piazza Club, which is nice, especially like if you just like want some AC on a hot day or you want to use like a genuinely clean bathroom that isn't the one that's like for everyone around. A lot of good food options around there. Really good view. Like there's nothing ever blocking you whatsoever. And if there is rain, you are covered. So I'm just going to go the 300s behind home plate from like third base to first base.
Yeah, I'm with you on there. And just to give a different answer, the area in right field, I think, has the best combination of accessible bathroom, many food options, and also just being a value. It's not like the best view, but like when you get, once you go underneath the overhang, it's not that good of a view anymore. But when you're on the line still, like where we sit every single year for Ernie's birthday, that's a good view of everything. And again, right behind you, you have the World's Fair Market where you have burrito bowls and sushi and all gluten-free stuff. And you have the rice balls over there with Arancini Bros. Arancini Bros. You have the lobster roll right there a lot of people love. And you right there, you also have Sweet Chick, which is a good addition to the ballpark. So you have a lot of stuff right there. There's multiple places to get beer. There is a bathroom right there, male and female. You're close to the bridge to do all that fun stuff and get the center field if you want to take a break over there. I like being over there. We spent a lot of time in that corner last year.
Yeah, specifically in the Arancini Bros corner. We a lot at that table, as we know. Shout out the Arancini Bros table family as well.
Shout out some other you guys because we've answered kind of your questions already. Brandon Lux, who talks a lot, favorite Mets prospect. We talked about prospects a lot last week, so changed it up a little bit. Jack Bennett, pitching development. We talked a lot about that already. Damier, you're the guy, but we talked about Christian Scott already too. So keep moving on. This is a fun one for Mark. I want to know here this one. Bell at Bell CT613. Nice rhyme. I love Francisco Alvarez, but the comparisons between him and Gary Sanchez are terrifying. To reassure fans, is there anything that supports that Alvarez can be a better hitter, especially OBP wise, than Sanchez was? Is what kind of progression do you realistically expect from him? Mark,
don't make me say it. Because I know they're shockingly similar, concerningly similar. I'm just going to say because he's got more dog than Gary. I feel like if there's anything that Gary Sanchez did lack ever, it seemed like he just kind of was good at baseball and didn't maybe work to improve when things got tough. It seems like Alvarez is someone who is not content with being as good as he is right now. We saw how much he improved defensively. We saw how hard he was working with Glenn Sherlock. We know how much the pitchers loved throwing to him. Max Scherzer and Verlander spoke just amazingly about throwing to Francisco Alvarez, which has got to be so awesome for a 21-year-old to hear. It seems to me that maybe the difference between the two, because there are so many similarities, could be the fact that I think Alvarez will not allow himself to get worse. I think he's a guy who's just addicted to getting better.
Yeah, and something else about Sanchez. The years he really started coming on, he was significantly older than Alvarez already was as a player. Sanchez, the first time he got like a cup of coffee in the major leagues, 2016, where he went crazy, he was already 23. In 24, the by far best year of his career, he was 24 years old, 2017. So that kind of development, that kind of progression, the fact that Alvarez has done it younger than Sanchez is significant. The fact that, and again, this is kind of a cop-out, but the fact that Alvarez was just always considered a bit of a better prospect, always had a little bit better physical tools, always had a little better standings with the scouts. And then to echo what Mark said, the fact that, again, he is doing leadership things where he's going down to the DR and handing out diplomas. Like, he's involved with everything.
The best is tattooed on his neck.
Yeah, like, it's a weird answer. I mean, because also, like, it's not impossible. I'm not going to lie to you guys and say it's impossible. Like, Alvarez has a lot of flaws in his game offensively. Like, he takes hacks. Like, his OPPs might suffer. Like, he's probably never going to hit for a high average unless something crazy happens. Like, Gary Sanchez was doing those first few years when he was hitting everything. Sanchez then, it was a different game. It was 8 years ago now, but he was striking out even less than Alvarez was last year as first year in the pros. Again, different age, different context, different team, different ballpark, different situation. But it's not impossible. Even a guy like Cal Raleigh, like, it took him like 4 years of playing in the major leagues to kind of hit his next stage. Like
Jonah Heim.
Catchers develop slowly. Catchers like 26, 27, 28 is kind of when you come into your own. The fact that we have this signal on Alvarez, a 21-year-old, which we said ad nauseum last year, is important just for that reason. The fact that he's already doing things at 21 that usually guys don't do until they're 24, 25, 26. Sancho's doing it 23, 24. That's why people thought he was elite. Then it just stopped. It could always just stop. There's so many factors on the field, off the field that contribute to player development. But I can't tell you it's impossible. And I am worried about his OBP long term. But I still think he just has so many things off. And Maddie talked about this too. Like, he has a nature to him that like other baseball players don't have. I think that's really, really relevant.
I mean, he's a baseball rat in the good sense, because I know we have the bad rats like Jose Alvarado and Ender Inciarte, but he's a baseball rat in the sense it just seems like if he's not playing baseball or working out, he's sleeping. Like, he doesn't really do anything else besides that. And to be fair, unfair to Gary Sanchez, didn't keep close tabs on him like I do with Francisco Alvarez now, but it just they don't feel the same makeup-wise. Play-wise, totally see the similarities, though. And that could scare some people. Another player, another young guy here, question from All Hail David Stearns. Love that name on Twitter, by the way. How long do the Mets give Vientos to prove himself with the bat this season before they make a definitive yes or no decision with his future with the club? My take is that Mark Vientos does not open the team with the major league club. I think he starts the year in AAA, and I think they're hoping for a hot start and to trade him. I think that they almost have plans of never seeing him play for the Mets again.
Yeah, this is a situation of our hive mind working here, because I was about to give the bold take. I don't even think he's on the Mets roster opening day. Whoa. He to me smells like one of those like end of spring training trades where you two teams just trade guys who kind of need a fresh start, who different fit. Like, this is going to sound funny, but because I still think Mark Vientos has significant potential with the bat. He's still projected to be a better than league average hitter, but
the power is legit.
Yeah, totally legit. And he's just, this is the kind of guy that's, this is going to be funny. This might be a little mean, but he's the exact kind of guy the Mets used to trade for, where it's like there's no obvious fit, but you have a little bit of potential. You can't play a position. You're a little bit one-dimensional, and that's kind of it, where that's just not the way David Stearns has built his baseball teams in the past, and there's enough guys around this Mets roster that do something similar without having any kind of value in the field, to where it's like if there's something that can be done to make this team better and it's not Mark Vientos, I think I could see it happening.
Yeah, and I think that's the big thing, too, is there really is no incentive to trade him right now. There's no reason to have to trade him. It's just that if they can move him to make this team better right now or in the near future, it might just have more value than Mark Vientos could possibly ever have with this New York Mets team.
And bottom line, it's like weird roster manipulation shit, but you gotta sometimes like build a bench in your mind, because you have to think about what these teams are thinking about on a game-by-game basis. He's just a right-handed hitter without a position. So like, you lose platoon value, you don't have defensive value, like you have to hit the piss out of the ball to have some real value. Like, he has to go to spring training and hit 6 home runs probably to make the team, just because, not that he's not major league ready himself, but more like the fact that his strengths and weaknesses as a baseball player don't really benefit this roster so much the way it's constructed.
No, he's replaceable right now. That's kind of, he has to make himself unreplaceable. Is that the right word? Unreplaceable?
Irreplaceable.
Irreplaceable is what I was trying to say. Beyonce. Yeah, I should have got that one right. But yeah, I think we're probably harsh on Vientos, and I know that a lot of people have a lot of high hopes for him. I was disappointed in what I did see, because it's just, there was so much hype with every single person tweeting out how many AAA home runs he hit last year. But just goes to show you, it also doesn't really matter at all.
No, not at all. Keep moving on here. Some more questions. This one from the Brunson Burner, which is another good name. Who had the best one-game performance for a Met last year?
Man.
There was that game Francisco Lindor had in September. Maybe it was a doubleheader combined, but I think he had like two homers, a double, like seven RBIs. I remember it basically won me a fantasy championship, so that's why it's fresh in my mind. But
oh, yeah. What about, didn't Senga go eight against
Rockies?
The Rockies, maybe
10 strikeouts or something.
I will say, like, I hard really like tried to black out last year from my memory, because it was just so miserable. And I know we talked about like every single game, but it was not what we wanted to say. So I don't even really remember what my thoughts were, because I just know that it wasn't right.
best sale game performance for a Met was probably the DJ Stewart day. Literally the day that we interviewed him. And he hit two home runs and made the game-saving catch in right field. I think that was the one. So we're going to take
that. Alvarez home run, too, in Arizona was a big one. He had a big game. He had the couple home runs in Cincinnati as well. Pete had the game-winning home run against the Rays, right? Was it against the Rays?
That was fun times.
That was a big one. Oh, man, when we thought we were back in the playoff race, that hurts.
Yeah, and then he said, let's fucking go, Max. And Buck said, we don't talk like that in this team. So,
he didn't just say that. He went to Michael Kay and cried to him because, you know, Buck Showalter's a Yankee at heart. So got to make sure that he kisses the shoes of Michael Kay, one of the most overrated announcers in all sports. All right, let's move on here.
A couple more here because we're going long now. We're just talking about nonsense. But, Nick, our friend Nick Hawal, what ballpark food would you consider to be animal if you saw someone eating it?
We always talked with Vito and John about the people who eat the ballpark nachos out of the helmet and then they clean out the helmet inside the bathroom and then they wear it on their head afterwards. That's like the pure sign of animal. And honestly, if you do that, I'm sorry that we're calling you that right now, but you need to know that's not okay.
Yeah, I think that's the only other thing in the ballpark that's like, oh, there's one other thing actually, I think, in the ballpark that's animal, and that's... That's the burger that's covered in cheese.
Oh yeah,
that's the one. That thing's insane. If your body and your digestive system can handle that, like, shout out to you, kudos. Like, you got a wood chipper in there. Like, I respect you a lot. But if I see someone eating that and just their cheese on their wrists, I'm out.
The cheese covered burger is something that, again, like, wasn't even on my mind because there's just never a world where I can eat that. But I'll tell you what, if I could eat cheese, I'd get it one time.
One time for shits, but I think that's kind of it.
Well, yeah, you'd get the shits for sure.
Yeah, I had a double entendre there accidentally. Let's see what other stuff question. I mean, maybe this last one, just the last prospect thing. A lot of these other ones are either not Mets related. Like one guy was like Brody Morris. Like, I know it's the Mets podcast, but you guys have any insight to the Red Sox offseason?
Okay.
That's an okay question, but I don't think we're gonna answer. I don't think anyone cares about that who's listening to the show. Noah O'Neill, if Marte is himself again, what do you see as a timeline for the call up of Drew Gilbert or Jet Williams? Love the pod, boys. I think that it would be super crazy if Jet Williams got to the major leagues this year.
Yeah.
I think he would have to force the Mets' hand in a way that was like untenable, where he's in AAA and he has a 170 WRC plus and nothing is landing in center field. But Gilbert, I think, is realistic because David Stern said last week on the show with John Hamm and Joel Sherman, some legends right there, that Gilbert's going to start the year in AAA. So Gilbert starting here in AAA means that he's probably just next up. Like, he is the depth outfielder. So if there's a serious injury to someone who is really good in the outfield, his name I'm not going to say because I don't want him to ever get hurt again. I think then you're if there's like a 6-week injury for one of the guys who probably is going to hit lead off for the team, I think that's when Drew Gilbert gets the call. Otherwise, I think there would have to be, again, a significant injury or someone would have to be really bad.
And I think this, like, bringing in a guy like Tyrone Taylor kind of gives you that cushion too of like, if there's a little bit here and there, if there's a Marte injury, like if Drew Gilbert starts off slow, there's no pressure for him to have to come up right now. Cause I think that seems like,
and there shouldn't be.
Yeah. I think that's what the Mets are really trying to prioritize. It seems like with all their prospects right now is there's just, we don't want any pressure on these guys when they come up because we saw Brett Beatty feel the pressure. It definitely affected his play. I think Ronnie Mauricio even felt the pressure a little bit towards the end of last year because if you look at his numbers, guys, Ronnie Mauricio did not play well last year. He just did like some fun things, but relatively speaking, he did struggle, which makes sense. Like, his game has holes as well. But I think from what we see with David Stearns and how he handled prospects in Milwaukee, he really wants to take his time and make sure these guys are ready before bringing them up to the majors. And then if they show they're capable, go ahead and do what you do best. But like, even a guy like Sal Frelick, who was so ready for such a long time, took a minute to get called up in Milwaukee and then even took a minute to get into like the middle top of the lineup because they just want to ease these guys in. And that's something I think that gets lost sometimes with prospects and young players because we've seen Juan Soto and Ronald Acuna and Julio Rodriguez come up and they're the best players in baseball.
Totally. And I think the Mets did a lot this offseason to mitigate that just because we haven't had AAA depth like since we became adults by signing guys like Trace Thompson and Taylor Cole. So just like guys who can be competent and they're in AAA. So if you need them, you could dust them off and bring them up, non-roster invites. So they can, I think Trace Thompson doesn't have an option, but if he starts the year in AAA, he can be there. But if you call him up, you can't send him down, like one of those things. But again, it's just like if someone stubs their toe, like you call up one of them. But if somebody breaks their wrist, that's when you might call up Drew Gilbert if he's playing well. So everything's contingent on a lot of stuff. But first of all, of course, Drew Gilbert has to play well and then something has to happen. But I would be surprised if he had zero major league plate appearances this year.
Last one. This is going to be the last question we read out. It's from Gerson Echevarria. He's a good dude, friend of the pod. This is just a topic for debate. Everyone says we're on the cusp of a wild card team. I think we're a little bit better than a wild card, and I bet we have a surprise season. I think we are on the cusp of a wild card team. I think we're a team that will be competing for the wild card. And knowing that 83 wins, 84 is going to get you that last wild card spot, the Mets are totally in that realm of possibility of doing that and even outperforming that, I think, right now. There's just a lot of things that are going to have to happen in order for the Mets to outperform that expectation.
Yes and no. Right now, Zips Fangraphs projection system has the Mets projected at 84, 85 wins, which is right there with the Phillies, which I think would be surprising for a lot of Mets fans to hear, but also just goes to show like the fact this team does have very legitimate star power still. They have a better 1-2 punch, like 1-2-3 lineup than most other teams in the National League, especially the ones they're competing with for the wild card. Take out the Braves, the Phillies, and the Dodgers. Like, you look at the Mets 1-2-3 in their lineup, you're like, oh, okay, this is good. It's just really this whole thing is going to come down to if the Mets pitching development has created depth or not. That's going to determine if the Mets have 85 wins, 87 wins, or 74 wins, 71 wins. And I think we have a range of all in that. Like, I think that this season is fun for those reasons. Like, anything can kind of happen this year. And I think we're going to learn a lot about what's going on underlying in the organization for better or worse. And I think that is kind of where this is. I know the Pecota projection is going to come out soon. I know Vegas is coming out with the total soon, next couple of weeks, which is going to be really fun. We're definitely going to talk a lot of gambling stuff with you guys in this podcast this year, because that's something we weren't able to do before. And we're excited to break down futures and talk about stuff like that, a little in-game shit. But I think that, again, the Mets' range of outcomes this year, like, truthfully, 70 to 90 in my head for wins. And it just really depends on guys like, weirdly, like Luis Severino, Jose Budo, David Peterson, Christian Scott, like Jorge Lopez, like not really names that you ever expect like the season to hinge on, but those are kind of the guys it does hinge on.
No, 100%. I think that was a great way to bring back the mailbag a little bit here for the Mets Up podcast. A lot of good questions from you guys. Really appreciate it. Remember to follow us on our social media at Mets Up on everything, Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram. We do have some housekeeping things to go over. I just wanted to make sure that, you know, we get the social media plug while people are still listening. What else do we got here, James? We got Shota Imanaga signed. We saw that contract. That kind of sucked to see.
Yeah, I was like, fuck, I would love to give him $12 million a year. People were talking about over 20. I hope he's listening to this, because I gave our guy Marino some shit because he was like 100 mil, 100 mil. I was like, we told you that one, guy, but still love Mike. Wanted to have him on soon. That sucked. He also seemed like to really want to go to Chicago. Seemed like that was kind of his intention. He was just waiting, because when you were an international free agent, you have your posting period. You're just waiting until the last second. And I guess just pushing all these rumors out there, hoping somebody like threw too much money at him. But he's so interesting. And now the fact that he's making, again, like 12 mil, like 15 mil, kind of like the Senga contract rather than 20 mil like people were talking about, it makes him much more fun to evaluate, because now he's being evaluated like as a fringe starter like Senga was last year. So a lot of cool stuff there. We cut Diego Castillo from the 40 man to make room for I don't even remember. Someone signed this week. Cooper Hummel, we just traded. We cut him and traded him out for cash considerations. Castillo might have been Minaya, and Cooper Hummel might have been my guy Max Kranick, who the Mets picked up the other day.
Oh yeah, I think you're right. That would make sense. Yeah.
Kranick's fun. Pirates used him in like a 30-40 pitch role like a couple years ago, and he was like nice doing it before he got surgery. And he grew up a Mets fan, so love having people love the Mets on the team. And same with Mark's boy, Yaxel Rios.
Yes.
Throws 97 with a good slider and pitch, was part of the A's organization. Exactly what we want to bring in.
Ooh, I don't like that last little tidbit, part of the A's organization.
No, we want that, because then if you're with the A's, like, you've never been coached, you've never been developed, nothing's ever happened. We talked about this a few weeks ago. Like, there's more cream on top, where if you came from the Rays, the Astros, the Guardians, you have already been maxed out. And you're as good as you could ever be. But now we got raw talent here, 97 with some juice.
Something about that name Yaxel that I really just love. It's an electric name. Baseball Prospectus dropped their top. Is this a top 101? Am I reading that correct?
Top 101.
Top 101. Jet Williams comes in as the Mets top prospect at number 23, which is pretty sick. That's kind of awesome to have a top 25 prospect. Drew Gilbert at number 29. Ryan Clifford at 76. Luis Angel Acuna at 77. And Christian Scott at 88. Five guys in the top 101 for the Mets. Solid farm system. We know that they have a lot more depth than they have in the past. And to have a guy that we traded for Justin Verlander, two of those guys are in the top 75, basically. Pretty sick.
Yeah, and again, mentioned it before, but really cool that they recognize like Scott's pitch properties, even though he was statistically, I've tweeted on Monday from Mets Up, like probably the best pitch in the minor leagues last year. Highest strikeout minor walk rate, like second lowest FIP, like 11th lowest ERA, just despicably disgusting. Third lowest walk rate. they also, again, they give a lot of credit to pitch property. Jarrett Seidler and Jeffrey Pastrnado. I think Jarrett's definitely a Mets fan. Jeffrey, I'm not sure if he is or not, but I think they're both Jersey East Coasters. They're always going to be ruthless because they're Mets fans at heart, and they give a lot of credit to pitch design and the fact that they put Scott here, where it's remarkable, and I think it goes to show how good of a prospect he really is.
Nice. In terms of the major league team, arbitration negotiations were going on. Agree with everybody except my boy Philly B, Phil Bickford, which he's going to be a hot name on this podcast for no reason. Arbitration's so crazy that even exists still. Like, this is how we do contracts with players. It doesn't make any sense.
It's nuts. Like, for people who don't know, like, they exchange figures and have to agree in a contract. But if not, they literally go into a courtroom with a private arbiter, and they will argue. The teams will argue that their players are worth less money. Crazy. The Tigers are going to arbitration for Casey Mize, former number one overall pick, over $25,000. Yep. A Major League Baseball organization, they're going to spend that much on ice cubes in April. Like, it's not even funny, the fact that, like, their teams do this shit. And it's ruthless. Like, again, love to see players do it because you never want to see guys go to arb. It really hurt Corbin Burns last year. Fractured his relationship with the organization. Dellin Betances a long time ago with the Yankees. Mookie Betts. I'd love to do content on, like, arbitration cases that, like, hurt teams recently. And also just really nice to see Pete and the Mets, like, sign a dotted line together. It's not the real contract, but nice to see it go through.
I do appreciate all the people on Twitter who, like, freak out. They're like, oh my God, like, the Mets signed a contract with Pete Alonso. Like, no, this was always going to happen. Like, you didn't know what arbitration was.
There's
no
leverage. You can't not play.
Yeah, like, if he doesn't want to play, he can't play for anybody else. His contract doesn't continue on. Like, oh, I missed a year. Too bad. That was going on. And then the last bit of sad news here, Mets legend Bud Harrelson passed away. Only Met to be in uniform for both World Series.
Yes, third base coach, and I think infield coach for 1986, which I don't think a lot of people know, which is really cool. He famously was waving Ray Knight around home on the famous play in Game 6, but... Original Met, 1969, 1986. He was like that kind of gritty, tough-nosed shortstop that doesn't really exist in baseball anymore, but was kind of a mainstay for baseball back then. Everyone in the Mets family always had glowing things to say about him. Mike Breen had a touching tribute during the Knicks game the night he died, where he said, "I grew up with two heroes in sports. I've been lucky enough to sit next to one of them for the last 25 years talking about Clyde." And they said the other one was Bud Harrelson, as just a hard worker, grinder, did all the little things, did everything right. Great career, great life. Sad that he's passed away.
Yeah, very sad. One of the great Mets, and definitely, like, you talk to our parents, you talk to anybody over the age of ours, and they bring up Bud Harrelson all the time as just one of the greatest Mets ever. And really sucks. That's going to be how we end this episode here, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for watching. Remember, if you're looking for the YouTube version of the video, Mets Up Podcast on YouTube. We will link it. We always link it on Twitter and stuff. We throw it on Instagram. We'll throw it everywhere so that make sure you guys can find the actual correct link so you can see the video version of this. If you're listening to us, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, whatever it is, drop us a rating, drop us a review, download and subscribe. It really does help us out. Follow James on Twitter at
James_Shiano.
And me at GiraffeNeckMark with a C. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you for watching. And we will catch you probably next week, unless something big happens, for another episode of the Messed Up Podcast. Peace out.
Peace out. See you guys next time.